challenges, opportunities as a black person. I like that. Okay.
Well, yeah, to be honest with you, it's, you know, like I've been in Europe for 6 years. I came in 2014, September, right? And it has been a journey. Okay.
Don't spill the juices yet. Don't spill the juices yet.
All right.
So with that, let me just go right into it. I would just start by introducing the podcast itself. So it's something that just started a couple of weeks back, and it has been quite well accepted. It's called The Diary for Young Professionals. So there are three parts of it. One part is the business part, one part is the culture, one part is leadership. And I believe all of these are somehow, you know, intertwined, and not somehow, all of these are linked, because you talk about culture, you talk about leadership, you talk about leadership, you talk about successful businesses. So we're bringing all these together for a young professional, kind of sharing stories that could benefit young professionals as they are onboarding into their exciting careers, I hope exciting. And if they realize that it's not the right career path for them, then having that aha moment. There's also another part that's a little bit serious. It's called Engineering Pioneers, and then that's more technology oriented, maybe going a little bit into the formal side. But The Diary for Young Professionals is really a lighthearted information stories to share. So I'm quite excited to have you, and I am looking forward actually to hear your story and your experience, because somebody asked for this as well. You know, people were like, hey, I want to know how African people are doing in the West. You know, how are you integrating? How are you thriving? So I'm excited to hear that from a black man's perspective, because I always hear the black women's stories. And then this is quite different. So Ben, Benedict Mutipa, please introduce yourself. Quite thrilled to have you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, thank you for giving me the opportunity to be able to present myself and, well, say my story. So I am I'm a business analyst currently in a pharmaceutical company called Novo Nordisk. And also I'm currently working as a Scrum Master. So this is very, you know, Scrum Master is a very technical term, because when you're a Scrum Master, that means you work in an agile environment where we are, and that is more into IT. But I'm not an IT person by nature. I'm a pharmacist by profession. So someone would ask, how does a pharmacist move from being a pharmacist into IT project management? And it has been quite, you know, would you say this? Like a series of events which led me to find myself where I am right now in the information and technology industry, but it's still in the pharmaceutical industry. So I think
we want to hear all of it, all of it.
And I'm willing to share the path, because the path has been, you know, somewhat exciting. And so I started as a pharmacist, and then I tried my luck in, you know, community pharmacy, working in a hospital in Zimbabwe. But I feel like this wasn't cutting it for me, you know. I was like, okay, there should be more to pharmacy than this. Then I looked for a master's degree to say, let me further my education. And then that took me to France in 2014. Mm-hmm. Where I did my master's in drug design. Yeah. I feel like the question.
Well, what made you realize that this is not what you want in Zimbabwe?
It's more like every time you go to work, you just feel like this is monotony. You know, like the first few months when I was working in pharmacy, it was discovery. I was discovering new drugs, or how to prescribe this, or a new prescription. Mm-hmm. And then you find, you can prescribe this and that. And also you have to understand pharmacy in Zimbabwe is not like pharmacy in the West. Pharmacy in Zimbabwe is you have to make do with what that is there. So maybe somebody needs this kind of medication, but then you have to substitute with the third preferable one, you know? But I wasn't happy. I was like, no, this can't be it. I wanna give more. And then that's when I decided to pursue a master's in drug design. So I wanted to be at the beginning of drug design. So I came to France. I had an offer from the University of Paris Diderot, so Paris 7, to do a master's in drug design. Mm-hmm. And what made this drug design quite exceptional was that it was an international master's degree, which meant every semester you had to do it in a different university. So my first semester was in Strasbourg. Yes, my first semester was in Strasbourg. And then the second semester was in Milan in Italy. And then the third semester was in Paris. And then the final semester was an attachment in a pharmaceutical company. But each and every one of those had something that was specific. So we majored in molecular modeling, in data analysis, in virtual screening. But each and every one of these things we're doing computationally, you know. And I find that quite exciting. So that moved me more from working with people to working with computers in trying to find new drugs and what is exciting, you know, like what could be the next thing, what could be the next big blockbuster, you know? So that's what led me to France. And I actually felt a fulfillment when I was doing that. And after I finished my master's degree, I had an offer for a PhD in Germany to do big data. So, you know, like now is the big data. And I was doing machine learning and, you know, I moved to Germany in the south, in a city called Biberach. And I did I started my PhD there, which was quite nice. But me being Ben, after a year, I was like, I need something more. I don't see myself spending 3 years doing just a PhD. I need a new challenge. So after a year, I left my PhD. I moved into the pharmaceutical industry, where I started working as an IT project manager. So for Bayer Business Services. And then I was there also for a year and a half or so. And then I then relocated to Denmark, where I'm working still in the pharmaceutical industry, still in research and in development. But now I'm also doing still IT project management, but more in an agile setup where I work with a team which is located in different parts of Europe. So I've got some team members in Austria, in Vienna. I have some team members in London. I have some in Germany. And I am sort of like the scrum master. So when you're the scrum master, the one who coordinates the team on a daily basis, you figure out what do they want. What should I remove? What do you call them? Like roadblocks or stuff so that they can be able to do their job. And every 2 weeks they deliver a minimum viable product. So that's the journey. So it moved from being a pharmacist to studying drug design to doing a lot of data analysis to IT project management and understanding IT systems. And now I'm now fully encrusted in the pharmaceutical world, but with a lot of IT.
Wow, so, yeah. that's a lot. That's a lot to take in. Like you're just throwing these words like Bederick in Germany, Scrum, Big Data, IT, whatsoever. You know, I want us to go back to when you were in Zim, right?
Yes.
How did you choose La France? You know, out of all the places, why? Why France? And how was it, you know, to get there? Because I have a lot of people who are constantly asking, hey, I want to get out of Zimbabwe. I know I'm not doing what I want to do right now, and I want to experience the world. How did you do it?
France. Well, who doesn't want to go to France, right? But
I didn't. I'm being honest. I honestly didn't.
For me, the language is beautiful. So just maybe a few steps back before France, I did my bachelor's in Algeria. So that's another step, you know. I did my bachelor's degree in Algeria.
Okay, so you spoke French already.
Exactly. Okay. So I spoke French already. So with my bachelor's degree, I I had an option either to go to Germany. I also had an offer from a university in Bremen. But I wanted to see what France was all about. So I applied for universities in France, and the first one that took me was in Paris, and that's the one I wanted actually. They said, "Oh yeah, we would like to have you in our class. We look at your competences. We believe you make a good fit." But then I knew, because the fact that I speak French, it would be easy. But actually, the master's was in English. It was partly English, partly French, I would say.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But being in Zimbabwe, but then between Algeria and Zimbabwe, I have to clarify, there was 1 year which was spent in Zimbabwe. So when I graduated in Algeria, I had a patriotic commitment to say, you know what, I am a pharmacist. I want to give back to the community. So I want to go back to Zimbabwe and work in a pharmacy in Zimbabwe, or have my own pharmacy. And that was me. And I left Algeria. I wouldn't say I was naive, but in retrospect, I think I was really naive, you know. So I went back to Zimbabwe. I arrived in Zimbabwe, and then I applied for positions as a junior pharmacist, and all I could get were rejections at the beginning. Like, people would say to me, "You're overqualified to be a pharmacist." I'm like, "What do you mean?" And then they'll say, like, "Look at your CV." Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. Apparently, I was overqualified to be a pharmacist. I would go to interviews, and a guy would say to me, "Listen, I have three pharmacies. I'm the one who's managing them. But when I look at your CV, you look so like well educated. So in a year or two, you take up my position. So I can't employ you because you become a threat to my position." Yeah, they do that.
He say that to you in the interview? Are you kidding me?
Exactly. Yeah, in an interview, I did. And then he said to me, "I just need a basic pharmacist. You're too educated to be." And then he said to me, "You better go back to school because you're more of an academic person than." And then I was like, "Okay, this is strange." But finally, I managed to get a place in Bulawayo at the United Bulawayo Hospitals, because I come from Bulawayo, and I worked there for a year, and I got my hands on. But like I said, after a few weeks, you get the hang of it, and then you are thinking to yourself, I'm 25, or was I 26? Yeah, I'm 26, and if I'm going to be every day of my life, then this is not fun, you know, because it's the same stuff. You get a prescription, and then the patient, and they're like, "What do you feel? Okay, you have hypertension. Okay, you get to get this." But I wanted more, you know. So then I decided to, you know, to specialize, and my logic was, if this doesn't work out, I will come back to Zimbabwe and be a highly qualified pharmacist, you know. But if this also works out in Europe, I get to pursue other paths.
And go back and take the guy's job.
I feel like I'm very petty. Maybe one of these years I might just go back to take his job then.
No, don't do that. Yeah.
But no, I wouldn't do that. But
I was going to ask you for the name.
No. We just give him the benefit of the anonymity, the gentleman. But yeah, but it's something that's so shocking. I have to say, this is one of the concerns. I didn't think through to think that you could be educated abroad, but if you try to go back home, they can be an issue of integration where you're not accepted as one of your own, you know, like as in you are a Zimbabwean and you want to give back. And it's a thing, you know, because most of the animosity I got from these guys was more like, "Oh, so you went to study abroad, you went to study in Algeria, you thought you were better." But it wasn't even that case, because Algeria was a scholarship, you know. So that's what I experienced. And to be honest, maybe had the environment been better or anything, maybe we'd be talking about a different story where I decided to set up shop in Zimbabwe, opened up a pharmacy, you know, got married and maybe lived happily ever after. But it was really, it's hard for people when they go back to Zimbabwe. They get this resistance from the locals, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. I know what you mean. And then the reverse culture shock, you know, I was also like you a bit, in the sense when I finished my undergraduate studies, I wanted to go back to Africa. I didn't want to go back to Zimbabwe I wanted just to go somewhere on the African continent to give back, you know, the being naive, just, you know, I would say my mind was set. And when I did experience it, I realized that, no, I need to do something else. And I can always come back to that position of giving after I've actually gained enough foundation to give back. And, you know, you said something interesting because you then went on to France. You moved from this people nature or people environment, and you wanted to move more to this IT data setup. And then you studied in Paris, Milan, and what was the third place?
So I was in Strasbourg was the first one, and then Milan was the second one, and then third was
in
Paris.
Strasbourg. And Strasbourg. Did it meet your expectations in terms of what you had envisioned when you left Zimbabwe? And you know, you touched on something, but I feel like that's going to be another discussion on this, you know, returning national who wants to give back, and the treatment from the people is a bit different. We'll touch on that later on. But right now, I want to know, did the whole process of moving out of the country after having the idea that you wanted to give back and then realizing, no, let me do something else or else I'm, you know, stuck in this web, did it meet your expectations? What were the challenges that you faced when you came into this European setup, which I believe was quite different from the Algerian one? I've heard horrific things about Algeria. I've also heard beautiful stuff about Algeria.
Yeah, so, yeah, Europe was it was an exciting experience. Did it meet my expectations? Yeah, yes, it did, because I got to be challenged in areas where I wasn't really, like to say, I was comfortable in. Because remember, I was a pharmacist, so I'm more into pharmacy and drugs, and now we're moving into programming. Python programming, I have to do, you know, talking about molecular modeling and all this kind of stuff. And that, for me, that was exciting because, for example, as a pharmacist, what you get in a pharmacy is a box of paracetamol, right? But you do not know how did this thing get to be conceived. Now, I was at the point whereby you do what is called virtual screening. In virtual screening, you're screening possible compounds that could be able to attach to a binding site, but you're doing this at a computational level. So you're running an algorithm which you have a binding site, and you're running through these virtual molecules, and then by some chance you get to have a list which are called hits of 10 compounds that could be potential candidates. So then you now try to optimize those hits to bind specifically to that target. And then you do different, you know, substitutions. And then after you've found one, you go through it through a molecular dynamics simulation to see what is their binding affinity. And all this is now, we're talking in terms of it's now computers, but we're using computers for the drug discovery. Because the idea in silico drug design is we're trying to be able to simulate how a drug sort of like works in a human being without actually having to put it in a human being. So what that means, we try to do all these things in a virtual environment such that by the time we manufacture the compound, it should be able to follow the same path as the one we have predicted. So it's more like a prediction software, you know? And this was new territory for me. I was like, wow, this is so exciting. That means I can be able to go back to Africa, crush maybe like one of those local herbs, and then try to find which molecules are there and try to figure out when I chew this root, what is it that actually doing the effect, you know? So in my mind also, when I studied in silico drug design, I always had this part of home. How would I apply this to a Zimbabwean setup? How will I help in the drug discovery of Zimbabwe? Because I know, like, for example, I can tell you personally, my grandfather was a herbalist. You know, like, he used to treat people with herbs. And they always used to wonder, how does he know this? And I also used to wonder, how does he know that if I take these leaves, I crush them, you know, that sort of thing. But I guess for him, it was just a trial and error, or it was just a sort of like oral traditions. But now I was getting an idea how actually the compounds work chemically. So I was so fascinated. Actually, that's actually what even drove me.
Wow, that's so profound. That's so profound. Because you know what? A lot of people do not acknowledge indigenous systems. And I, you know, when I think of your grandfather, who was a herbalist, your grandfather, and most people today look down sometimes upon the solutions that we have had for years, you know. And then what you said is so powerful, because you said you went from having the paracetamol, right, and, you know, to now actually discovering how do I create something that is relatable to where we are, which is something so powerful. Because, you know, a lot of us, and then I feel when I'm in the African sphere and seeing the products that are on the market, they're so Western tailored. Most, and I'm not saying all of them, but most of the time, and I love seeing products that are really creative and really addressing the issues at hand, and looking at, do we have a solution on an indigenous level? Because these are things that people back then didn't do in the past, different levels, but they were creative.
True. So when you are studying pharmacy, there's one module called pharmacognosy, you know, and it is the study of plants and how they heal people. I'm going to give you an example which we use every day. You know aspirin, right? Aspirin is known as acetylsalicylic acid. So it's an acid which is used for to reduce pain and fever. But actually, the acid is found from the leaves or from the willow tree. The willow tree. So technically, aspirin is from a leaf. And then they crush it, then they process it. So meaning even most of the medications we know, like today, they have been a derivative of a compound or plant. That's just they got to be chemically enhanced to be able to be specific and reduce the side effects. When you take a compound from, for example, when my grandfather crushes them, definitely there will be some side effects, but the main effect will be there, like, for example, to reduce pain or to stop bleeding and all that stuff. So the thing is, there's a lot of plants which have a healing effect. And also, you know, like, for example, we have aloe vera, we have moringa. There's so many I could mention, which actually are used for healing purposes, but just that we haven't commercialized them as per se, you know? So the idea was to say, it's easier when I tell my people to say, actually, when you eat that herb, this is what you're actually gaining. And then that would make them understand also, like, for example, when you eat this herb, you might also feel dizzy. It's okay, because also there are these effects that come along with it. It's just a matter of adding more knowledge to a knowledge that was there, which has been passed from generation to generation. But because some of these herbalists, they just try to remain anonymous, and maybe they think secrecy is part of, or it's like the tricks of the trade or secrets of the trade, they do not reveal much. But as a pharmacist, it's my job to protect the patient. So I need to explain to them, you can only chew maybe 2 leaves per day, but don't have to chew the whole tree, because then you have what you're you know, then you suffer from toxicity. So these are the things. And I feel when medication was brought to Africa, we had this mentality of being told, don't question, just take. But now it's our role to actually question, and we be able to explain to people, do you remember grandfather used to do this? Actually, here is the science behind it. So that actually people don't see science as an enemy, but science as an enabler. So, yeah.
Exactly. That's powerful. That's really powerful. And I think this is the future role of successful young professionals, where you go from that routine to questioning, to recreating stuff that will be used in the future to come. I want to know, you know, I want you to spill the juice on how it was when you entered your first position. I believe it was in the West in Germany. You did mention that you did do a PhD for 1 year and realized that wasn't the road. the academia world wasn't it. And then you went to work as an IT project manager. I want to know, how was your first experience getting into the working world as an African, being yourself? Because I want to assume that you brought yourself into work.
Yes.
Your entire self, yeah.
That's a very good question. Thank you. So there are many different aspects, you know, like when you ask this question, because there's the African part and then there's the African man in it, you know. So as an African person, you know, like as an African, because like you said, the experience are different when it's a woman and when it's a man. So for example, when I, people, when you are a black man standing there, there are two reactions you might get. Some people might actually be afraid of you because of the stereotype of the black man that they know, this man who's very aggressive or forceful. And then some have the stereotype that the black man doesn't know anything, you know. So my experience was, I had an amazing team. My boss who recruited me, I believe he's one of the best bosses I've ever worked with, because he knew me, and from the interview, he could tell what were my strengths, and he would work towards my strength and also develop me to be the person I was. And it made me feel easy. So on our first one-on-one meeting, my first day at work, we sat down. He said, Ben, the reason why I recruited you is because I feel like you are very bubbly, you are energetic. I look at your CV, you have tried so many things, and I am also a new team lead, and I need you to help me bring this team together. That was him. He was just honest from the first day. I need you to help me. I want you, the team that I have seems to be so it was distributed towards different sites. But I want you to help me bring this team together. And from what you exhibited, you have these qualities to be someone who's like a team player, who you can help me do this. And what would you expect from me? And then he said to me, what would you want me to do in exchange? And I said to him, I want you to push me out of my comfort zone, you know, because I know myself. Nice. I know my personality. I know I'm charming. I know I can get but also I know when I get comfortable, I get bored. So I asked him also in exchange, I want you to push me to always be out of my comfort zone so that I can continue to be better, you know. And that was the dynamic between me and my boss. Nice. And that was going to be very important for the following path. Because the first thing I would give advice to people is whenever you get your first job, you have to make sure you and your immediate superior, you're on the same page. Be eloquent. Tell him what are your expectations from this role. I told him, this is my first role in a professional environment, but I want to grow, and this is what I would like to grow. And in exchange, ask them also, what do they expect from you? It's like any relationship. You say, what are your expectations from this relationship? What do you expect? And then we were clear from the first day, which meant for the following 1.5 years when I worked in that company, I knew I had his back. Even sometimes he would get projects and he would say to me, when I saw this project, I knew Ben, you were the best fit for it, because I know this will do this for you. So it was really very, very well, because even when he would give me a project, he would tell me, I'm giving you this project because I believe it will be able to enhance you in this department and in this department or this aspect of your career development. So that was the relationship I had with me and my boss and also with the rest of the team. Now let's talk about the external people I used to work with. Because as an IT project manager, I manage implementation of a IT software for the organization, meaning I work with a lot of external vendors. These are people who are trying to sell a product to the company. So they're trying to sell a product, and then I have to assess, do we need it? And if we need it, is the price you're charging okay? So now when you come to this environment, the first thing when they see a black man. So some people will be like, then this is going to be easy. And then when you talk to them, the first thing, then they realize you are, first of all, you're eloquent. you are smart, and you really know your stuff. This kind of takes them off guard, which then comes to these certain of questions, which are the first one, where did you study? And then, okay. And then
you must have studied somewhere else.
Exactly. And then they ask you, are you French? And then I'm like, no, I'm not French. I'm Zimbabwean. Huh. Well, for a Zimbabwean, you're really eloquent in English. Do you guys speak English in Zimbabwe? I'm like, yeah, yes, we do. And then it's like it's frying their brain. They can't pin it. Like, so let me get this straight.
Like, what's going on?
Exactly. Like, what's going on? Because they are trying to put you in a box, and you're just breaking every corner of the box. Like, you can't be fit in a box.
And then yes.
So did you come straight from Zimbabwe to France? Like, no, I went to Algeria. Wow, now this is an Islamic country. They like everything, because people like to put people in a box, especially black people. Like, this is who you are, and you should abide by these rules. And then in that aspect, you know, you would smile it off and like, no, you explain to them how you become where you are. And then as you go further, there is also the part where they sometimes question your knowledge, but they don't do it directly. So, for example, when you're working on a project, and then someone says to you, for us to be able to get this, we have to do this and that and that. And I'm like, okay. Then they say to me, but did you understand? I'm like, yeah, I did. But then they would never do it if it was another race. But to me, they go like, should I explain it better? I'm like, no, it's fine. I got it. They're like, okay. And then I say to them, you said, for you to do this, you have to do this, and that. Okay. Exactly. You got it. You know. Now, what happens is, after some time, they give feedback to my boss. They go like, "Wow, Ben, such a smart guy! Like, I didn't expect that." And always the question my boss asked, like, "What did you expect? Like, what were your expectations?"
I love your boss.
Yeah. So it wasn't easy, but it was made easy by the fact that I had someone who had my back, you know. And even when I left my company to come to Germany, I still feel pain, because he was amazing, and he also said, I understand your reason for leaving, because you know you're going to join your wife and you cannot be in two different countries. But it was a pleasure. And it's someone who, even today, we still talk together on Instagram and everything. But you have to understand, like, that's this beautiful. Was a relationship we started from the first day, you know. And that has been my experience. But you have to have a thick skin. This is my advice. Like, for, so you need to have a thick skin. You need to be really straightforward about what you want and what you're willing to, you know, for example, to give. And there are things which shouldn't shake you, you know, like, for example, when people are just being condescending, basic, just tell yourself, this is not my struggle. I know what I want, and this is where I want to go, you know, so, yeah.
It's interesting for me. I mean, I didn't know that black males also experience that, because I hear it a lot from female peers, where I have people around me who are high achievers, which means you're going into the workplace not just to, you know, to make a day by day, but to thrive, to be successful. So I have people around who are hardworking, who go the extra mile. And then the feedback I get from most women is, you know, you have to work twice as hard in order to prove that you are competent. And it's interesting to hear that as well from a black male, you know, from that it's a common thing that Africans experience in foreign lands, where there might be expectations. And like you said, this box, you know, to fit into a box. And I like how you handled it, you know, smooth, respectful, and graceful. I do understand that you moved now for love, which is something that I hear there and then, and I'm always curious to know from people who move for love, especially a man. That's something quite quite foreign. The percentage of males who move for their loved one who's female is quite low. So I'm quite interested to hear what were the deciding factors to move to where you are now in Denmark. I mean, I know the love part, but why Denmark? Yes. Why did you both decide? Yes. Well, let's do Denmark.
Yeah. So yeah, that's true. Well, my wife is amazing, so that was the first part. She lives in Denmark. She lives in Denmark, so she works in Denmark. She's from Burundi, so Claudia is from Burundi. So her name is Claudia. She's from Burundi, and she studied in France also. So she was in Bordeaux, and then she got a job in my company. So we work in the same company, in Novo Nordisk, and then she moved. Yeah, so she moved here in I think 3 or 4 years ago, 2016. To come and work as a trial data manager. So she's a data manager or data manager. I don't know which one to say. As a data manager, and then she works in clinical trials. And during that time, we were friends. And then over the course of time, you know, friends became very close friends. And then I was like, you know what? Why don't we try dating? She was not keen. She's like, but we're best friends. What if this doesn't work out? I lose your friend. You know how the story. But actually, it did work out. And then we started a relationship when I was living in Cologne.
I'm so happy for you.
In Copenhagen. Thank you. So now we were faced with an issue where we live in two different cities. We have two different apartments. I have my apartment, she's her apartment. And every weekend, I'll fly to either Copenhagen or she would fly to Cologne. So we're alternating. And I can say for a full year, we were alternating. Once every week, we would see each other. But I would either move there or she comes. So it was nice, you know, but also we're trying to figure out if this is going to work and all that part, you know. And then when we saw, okay, this is for real, like I want to be with you. Then we looked at what are the possibilities. Can you come to Germany or I should come to Copenhagen? And then we actually had an Excel file where we put pros and cons of every city. Yeah, exactly. So like what is the pro of you moving to Cologne? So Germany was more like
in terms of a life. Nerdy family.
true. And we looked at it and we said like Cologne was cheaper. And I had a nice apartment and other stuff. And then for that time and at that moment in time, she was she was sharing a flat with two other people, you know. So at Cologne, we had the intimacy of our home. But when we were at your place, then there are your friends. But also at the same time, in Germany, she needs to speak German if she's to get a job. Whereas for me, I could just do. So in Copenhagen, you can do with English. So we weighed all these things and then we look at the job market. How easy is for her to get a job in Germany? How easy is it for me to get a job in Copenhagen? And I have to say, financially, Cologne looked a better choice for her to relocate to Cologne. But in terms of integration and everything, it was easier for me to move to Copenhagen because I speak English. Like, I work in an English environment. I don't even speak Danish. I've been here for a full year. And wherever we go, she doesn't speak Danish. So it's more easy to integrate here than it is in Cologne. But then there was the issue of I love my job and she loved her job, you know. So it now came down to the fact that I loved her and she said, "Pretty please, can you just do this for me?" You know, and I was like, "Okay, fine." And also, I think also it's about personality, you know.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. What were the perks? There must have been a perk.
Oh yeah, to be honest with you, it's just that I said to myself, okay, you know what? I'm an extrovert, so I knew it would be easy for me to get along with people and get a job. So I started applying for jobs in Denmark. And here's the funny part. I think this is so funny. So when I used to apply to Copenhagen, for example, in different pharmaceutical companies, I would apply, you know, in my motivation letter, I would, you know, write like, I have experience in the pharmaceutical industry, these are my skills, etc., etc. And I'll try to sell myself, you know. and time again, I would get rejections and everything. Then I saw this position in her company, which was really what I was exactly looking for. Like, for example, a Scrum business analyst, you know, you work with a scientist at the same time with IT, everything. I was like, okay, this is what I want. Then I said to myself, okay, you know what? I'm going to be so genuine that it's going to shock them. So when I wrote my motivation letter, I said, okay, I'm applying for this role because it suits my profile. And I really feel like I would enjoy doing this and that. But most importantly, my wife works in the same company, and I would actually be nice if we could both of us work in the same company.
And as it turns out,
yes, our company has family values, and they like it when actually a couple works in the same company. So, you know, so then I got an email like, we like your profile. Can we have a call with you? Then I was like, okay. So, you know, there's the first Skype interview. And they were so intrigued and fascinated to know, so what does your wife do? And all this. So it was more about, it would be nice for you guys to be in the same country. Of course, you fulfill the requirements because you have what we're looking for. But we even have more reason to have you because we already know you have a personal attachment. And this is another thing which actually I never thought. Like, in a big organization, they value the fact that you can have this family attachment, because now our company employs both of us, and it's a big company. Novo Nordisk is one of the biggest pharmaceutical companies, but they still have these family values to say it's nice to have, you know, to have you. And most of the time in my department, people ask me, how's your wife? Because she works in a different site. So she is in a different location. So we were not on the same physical location. So I'm like, I know she's fine. You know, she's doing this. And so there is that part, which what attracted to them the most was actually the fact that she works there, I work there. And, you know, so technically my day is on my Outlook calendar. My wife can see, what am I doing? And suddenly she sends me a message.
Do you
have a meeting? I'm like,
oh my goodness.
I'm like, yeah. I'm like, whatever. Just check my calendar. Like, yeah, I can see you don't have a meeting. Do you want to chat? I'm like, okay, fine. What is it? Like, what are we having for dinner? Like, seriously? Why are you asking me about dinner right now? You know? So those are some of the things.
My heart just melted. My heart just melted.
So it was a plus to have her here and in the same company, and then I also moved here, and to be honest with you, I'm happy. I enjoy it. I enjoy the role. I enjoy, you know, I have someone who after work I can go home to, and we try not to talk about work, but sometimes we go like, you know, I'm working on this project, and I'm like, no. Actually, let's try to find out something. What are we going to watch on Netflix or something like that? Because, you know, you just try to remove the work out of our personal lives. But yeah.
How are you doing How are you doing right now? Because I mean, in the COVID-19 time, as I've heard, China has had an increase in divorce rates because suddenly people are together 24/7. Are you guys working from home? Are you still doing the, you know, different sites set up? How are you guys coping with the times?
Yeah, that's the thing. Maybe it's because we're a recently married couple, because we just got married in October last year. So we're like 6 months married.
Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you. So I think, to be honest with you, when you're married to your best friend, you don't get tired of your best friend. You know, like, you could even literally live together, bother each other. Like, I'm up on your nerves most of the time. She's up on my nerves all the time. But we love each other. And then the other thing which we did from the first day of home office, we decided who's going to take the bedroom and who's going to take the dining room. So we have two setups. So and then Claudia was like, I'm going to have the dining room. I was like, okay, fine. I can take the bedroom. And then our company, we're allowed to go back to work and bring our screen, our computer screens and our everything to have like a home setup. So I have my office set up in the bedroom and then she has her own office in the dining room. So literally, at 9 a.m. or 8:30, or sometimes she can even say, babe, I have to start working at 7. Because she has a department. They have a virtual breakfast with their team at 8:45 every day.
Nice.
You know? So they log in, they say hi. And then 9 o'clock, I'm in the bedroom and we have a separation where I do my stuff. And then at midday, I come out and go like, I'm hungry. What are we eating? and then we have lunch together, and then we go back again to work, and then we also sort of like set guidelines, actually. So that was her. That was even me. She said to me, we need to define what are the working hours. I'm like, okay, why? we need to work between 8 and 4 p.m. No one is supposed to do work after 4 p.m. I was like, okay, cool, you know. But sometimes I feel so tempted to send out an email. It's like, after 4 p.m., it's my time. Mm. And then so after 4 p.m., then we decide what to eat. Do you want to order? Depending on who's tired and who's more tired. And then we do that. But literally, we have enjoyed it because I'm in the other room. She's in the other room. And also, Denmark, unlike other countries, it's not like complete shutdown, you know. You can still go out. We go jogging. Mm-hmm. We do everything, you know. You cannot meet more than 10 people. So we can even sometimes visit our friends, have a drink on their balcony, you know. Just when we get to their place, we wash our hands and all that stuff. So it hasn't been really like me and her 24/7. It has been like me and her during the week, and then weekends we visit friends. Friends come over for dinner sometimes. And that's how we've been managing. So,
okay. You know,
and she also has, you know, she likes doing yoga. That's some white people stuff. I don't know why she does it, but yeah, she does yoga and stuff. Me,
well, it originated from India, so it is not a white people thing.
Oh, damn.
I love that you have a set time. It's actually a good thing, because a lot of what I've heard and I've experienced it myself is because you're in a comfortable setup, people tend to work more. So to have that clean cut and say, yeah, at 4, that's it, you know, finito, then we're spending time together. That's actually a really good thing. It's been so exciting to talk to you. I would love to go on. You know, I would like us to round up, and I want to talk about three things that I really found powerful as you were talking. I want to ask you, if you were to choose a place where you would work tomorrow, ASAP, everything signed, it has everything that you want contractually, where would it be?
Sydney.
And why?
Sydney, Australia. I like
why?
The weather. I don't like the cold weather here in Europe. I live with it, but I don't like it. And also, my next step is I want to work in a completely English environment, you know. So in Germany, I was, you know, I didn't speak German. So there's always a language barrier if you are living in a country where you don't speak the language of the locals. You understand? So, for example, in Denmark, my colleagues, sometimes they say we have a meeting in English, and then after the meeting, they wanted to do a little bit of gossip or go like, how was your weekend? So they speak in Danish. And then I'm like, oh, what's happening? You know, like there's a small part of social life you are missing. And also the same thing with your daily life, your television and everything. Some things are in Danish, but also, you know. So I would say, why Sydney? It's English speak. Everyone speaks English. It's the Commonwealth system, I guess. And then the weather is beautiful. I would take anything. And it's in the Southern Hemisphere. So definitely, I think if I see myself anywhere else, it's going to be in Sydney, Australia.
And Sydney, Australia. Okay. Me likes. I like good weather. The language thing, absolutely. That's a thing. And then, you know, you just touched the second point as well, which is I feel there are a lot of misconceptions of both worlds, you know. Like there are people working at home in Zimbabwe and they love it. But there's somebody who would get a job in Zimbabwe fitting everything. I mean, in terms of the salary and then so forth, family set up, fitting. But it would not be the right thing for them because they would want to experience the world. Or they're an introvert who just wants to, you know, go out and then be on their own and then be adventurous. And you said two things that are quite interesting, which I would just like to stress as well in this chat, which is, you know, when you're deciding where to go, it's a lot of things. And I like the list that you did with your wife. It's nerdy, but I love it, you know, because it breaks down what is so important to you, you know, because sometimes it gets down to what you say, the language. And the language part, it's not easy, because that's the integral part of, you know, interacting with people and being able to contribute as well to, it could be gossip and it could be as well in purposeful things, you know, in order to be self-fulfilled, right? You need your support system, you need people you interact with. And the other thing, the weather, which is quite quite often very, you know, not prioritized until you get to cold Europe where you have to wear your entire wardrobe and still feel cold. So I love your list item. I also like what you said on being authentic, you know, when you are applying for the job after all these rejections, right? A conversation that I have with friends over wine and stuff is how much of yourself should you expose in your work environment? You know, is there a thin line between who you are in your private life and who you are as a professional? I am a firm believer of bringing your entire self, which is all the things that you love, that you're passionate about, because this is what makes the DNA of who you are and how you contribute. And so I love the whole concept that your company has on this, you know, family values, and they really live up to that value. That your interview was even centered upon your wife.
Yes. And to be honest with you, like you said, about being authentic, it's, you'd be surprised how many CVs the human resources get. And because you are told to say this, each and every one of you would say the same thing and write the same things. Actually, even right now, I think they use even algorithms to just go through your motivation letter, right? But when you write something that you are passionate about, like something that is you, and that is what differentiates you from other people, because then you do not sound like the rest of the people. And for me, I didn't realize that, you know. And then when I did it, because actually, that's how I felt. Like today, I really want to work in the same place as my, because my wife would tell me every amazing things about their work, their Christmas parties, they get Christmas gifts, and I was like, wow. I really love your job. Like, I love what you work, you know, and how he lives
you
with
love the gifts.
Definitely, definitely. So being that authentic person. And also, one thing I should emphasize is also being African is beautiful. And I mean by that the fact that we are bubbly, we are full of energy. My first boss said, I chose you because you're very bubbly and you're energetic. It's a skill. It's a needed asset, because when people see you, they can see how you have this joy for life. You know, like we're all into, you know, like expressions, and even during the interview, they see how you laugh and how you're animated. It's good, because sometimes you're being told, yo, you just need to be formal, keep a straight back, and everything. I think when you're really passionate about the job that you want to do, you forget all those things. You know, you're just talking about, I want to do this, I want to do that, and that. And I think African people were so good in these oratory skills. Our body language says a lot, and people love that. So I've seen sometimes also my fellow brothers and sisters going like, I'm being trained to sound nice, to be nice, and I'm like, actually, maybe your best asset just you being you. You know, just your laugh, you know, the way you talk, you know,
exactly,
the way you connect people. Exactly. That's actually is just your major selling point. So don't sell it. I hear people saying they like Latinos because they're full of fire. We also have fire, but we're always trying to tone it down. Why? You know. So
Absolutely. That's a brilliant message. You know, just be you. Bring that, what makes you you, right? If it's the energetic laugh, even if it's, you know, what people are like, well calm it down. We have a formal professional laugh that we will be going through a training course to do. Don't change that. Don't change that. What would be your last takeaway message for particularly, I want it to be relevant to expats, right? Just in general, to expats, young professionals who are venturing into their first career. Even for those who are switching careers, right? I like that you also stopped the PhD and then said, no, this is not for me. And then, so what would be your takeaway message for expats? And then the number is increasing. There are over 1 in 10 people is an expat across the, you know, the world.
My message is simple to experts. My message is integrate, but don't lose yourself. It, you know, in as much as, you know, we come here, it's a different environment. It's important to integrate and to also respect the customs of where we are. But also at the same time, they also want to see where you come from and benefit from that part. Mm. You know, some they call it diversity and everything. But if you integrate, just make sure you don't lose yourself, because that's what makes you who you are. So I see quite a number of expats, because they really want a job. Sometimes people lose themselves. They start behaving in maybe, for example, they take social norms which are not theirs, you know. It's good to know, for example, if it's a birthday, you need to bring a cake, you need to bring in the cake. But also from time to time, tell them about how you do it, where you come from. For example, I tell them, for example, during the weekend, my mom attended a funeral of an aunt, you know, like, be yourself. They need to know what makes you different. You understand? So integration is important. You don't want to look, you don't have to be an outlier, but also, but then be like a star. Be unique. You know, that sort of thing. So you have to find that balance between integration and not losing yourself. So I will always say integrate, but don't lose yourself. So yeah, that's the takeaway message I can give to experts.
Love it. Love it. Thank you so much. What would you choose? Last question. A smoothie mixed all together with all the fruits, just, you know, made into this, I don't know what will come out. Or a salad, you know, with the fruits that are arranged into strawberries, oranges, bananas, you name it. Or a salad bowl that is mixed together without mashing the fruits together. What's your type of perfect integration model that you would choose?
I love smoothies, and I'm not much of a fan of salads. So when you say smoothie,
shame on like, you!
I love smoothies. Salad. When I eat a salad, I'm like, what did I gain from this thing? You know, like I was just chewing some leaves, you know. But definitely it's gonna be a smoothie. I love bananas, don't get me wrong, but I can also get them in a smoothie, and I'm always buying different kind of smoothies. I'm gonna be honest with you. I even buy frozen fruits and I crush them and I'm like, wow, I point some honey, you know, like I've been experimenting different kinds of smoothies. Salad is more my wife. She's forcing me to have salads and all that kind of stuff. But she knows there's a lot of resistance there. So smoothie it is.
Okay. So smoothie it is. So that's the message, guys. Make a smoothie for yourself. Be yourself. Put it into the smoothie, and I don't know what will come out. Thank you so much, Ben. It was so enlightening to speak to you, to hear your journey. I wish you all the best with your wife. It sounds like the perfect love story, and I love stories. And thank you so much for sharing that. Thank you.
Thank you for giving me the platform, and thank you for such an initiative. I think it's amazing, and I think I'm also waiting to listen to other people. I listened to the first one, the guy at Harvard, and I was like, wow, you know, like, interesting. So
nice. That's good to hear. Thank you so much. Thank you.